He's a former U.S. Army Green Beret. He served in Iraq, two tours in Afghanistan. He's got a football connection. Texas Longhorns long snapper, taught himself, by the way. Former Seahawk long snapper in camp in 2015. And Nate Boyer advised Colin Kaepernick to take a knee during the national anthem rather than sit in the 2016 NFL preseason games. You can follow him on Twitter, at NateBoyer37. And he is joining us on our Saturday podcast today. You know, it's interesting. Your life's become very, very public. I see you in a lot of places. You're a guy that taught yourself how to play football. Being a U.S. Army Green Beret is not a public life generally. So let's start with that. You seem to me to be very comfortable in not only a public life, but a public life of sparring often with people who disagree with you. So you're comfortable with it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I'm comfortable with it, but probably not the healthiest thing in the world sometimes to let some of that stuff get me fired up, get me ignited. But at the same time, I feel like it's often important for me to sort of engage with people and at least try to do it somewhat with a bit of education behind it, but also like playing devil's advocate to whatever side they're on. Typically, the people that are coming at me on social or whatever are people that have a pretty strong opinion, you know, one way or the other. And it's often what I call like a sort of an all or nothing, you know,
proposition.
Group.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And, I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of that from the military, especially being in the special forces, one of our, you know, what they call us in, I guess, one of our nicknames is like the warrior diplomats. Right. So our whole goal, with everything that we do, most of our missions are done through unconventional warfare and foreign internal defense. So we are working alongside, training, living with, and fighting alongside people from other countries that have completely different customs, things that we'll never fully maybe relate to and understand, but we have to respect. And we have to learn to work together and kind of put our differences aside. Especially in Iraq and Afghanistan, places like that, where it's just very, very different. Like there's no getting around it. You have to sort of let things go and just listen to them as human beings. And then once you sort of get past the minutia of things that are different about us, I mean, at the end of the day, as human beings, we all basically want the same stuff. You laugh about the same stuff. We want what's best for our family, and that's what it gets down to for me. So it's like, I understand that, like going into these things that like, just because somebody has a different opinion than me and all that doesn't mean they're just wrong or evil and they want to just destroy everything. And you know, a lot of people, I guess, don't really see that or they don't want to see that right now.
Well, as somebody who served as an Army Green Beret, Iraq, two tours in Afghanistan, and you had people saying you didn't understand the flag, you're not a patriot, which had to be infuriating, with your relationship with Colin Kaepernick. Why do you think the knee at its core bothered so many people? Have you ever sat down, talked to Colin about this? Like, why? I mean, Vin Scully was deeply bothered by it. Education levels often didn't matter. Vin Scully is one of the most literate broadcasters of my life. It bothered him deeply. That's the name that always jumped out to me. It didn't bother me as deeply. My dad had served, but I was not in your traditional military family. Did it make me less of a patriot? Why, at its core, do you think the knee bothered people? And were you surprised by the reaction? As it hurt television ratings. It had that much impact in the country.
I think, you know, the narrative about why was so, well, first of all, it wasn't correct. The one that was widely shared, widely spread, the narrative about why was so attached to the act. I don't think it would have mattered what he did. He could have stood with his hand on his heart and like bowed his head down or did something like that. They would have been like, traitor, unpatriotic, hates America, blah, 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 because, you know, he did say, I'm not going to stand for the flag of a country that oppresses black people and people of color. So like, But then he further explains, you know, why he's protesting, what he's doing. It's about police brutality. It's about social justice, racial inequality, all of these things. But it turned into, he hates America. He won't stand for the flag in America. He's unpatriotic. He's disrespectful. You know, it was never the narrative of, well, he chose this time, first of all, because it is a controversial time. It's an uncomfortable time during the anthem when, you know, it is something that a lot of people see as a very uniting moment. But at the same time, if he's not only standing because he doesn't feel that way, or he's standing for others that don't feel that way, they don't feel like they count equally, they don't feel united under that flag as I do, as Drew Brees does, as a lot of people do, people of color too, you know, people that serve in the military and people that don't serve in the military. A lot of them do feel that way. You're entitled to that feeling. But it doesn't mean just because he doesn't feel that way that he hates the country or that he's just, you know, utterly disrespectful and doesn't care. Like, he obviously, well, I don't know what to say, obviously. To me, he obviously cares enough to do that and enough to sort of stick to that. And, you know, and a lot of people agree with him, obviously, because there's a quite an outpouring of support.
Yeah, only 32% of Americans now are offended by it. I ask you the question, having an answer myself. I believe that when the flag represents our quality of life and our values, and he was disrespecting those. But if you're black, you see the world differently, and you've seen injustice. So it was the kind of protest that our Constitution has allowed, which is a peaceful protest to say you're not completely happy with the way people of color are being treated. My takeaway has always been, wouldn't you rather have a peaceful protest, which creates dialogue and context? That's what America's about. I've watched revolutions and protests in other countries on CNN, and it's not peaceful. It is chaotic and mayhem. 99% of our current protests, I'd say even higher than 99%, have been overwhelmingly peaceful. And so I think there's a lot of people that thought, many with police or military backgrounds, he was discounting or devaluing the American quality of life, which for a person of color in America is not the same. There are certain privileges to those who are not black. I mean, that was always my kind of base, simple evaluation of the situation. Make any sense?
Yeah. You know, but I wonder with that 32%, if that number is shifted quite dramatically, maybe even just in the last 2 weeks, not to mention the last 3.5 years, you know, when there's a little more, when people are looking at it more in, you know, in retrospect and compared to what some of the stuff we're seeing in the masses today. And also, like, how many people, I'd be willing to bet not that many. Well, a lot of people probably didn't realize how much support he maybe had, and how much many people in the country are now willing to, you know, kind of step up and say something, which it is a little more comfortable now, of course. At the time when he first started, I mean, it was 2 months before probably the most divisive election, at least in my lifetime, the most divisive election in a pretty divisive time. And so it was seen and kind of taken as a divisive stance, or me, or whatever you want to call it.
Let's be honest. As a U.S. Army Green Beret, did people reach out to you that you had served with and were upset with you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, well, and that was another, like, narrative that was not nearly as popular as, like, you know, what Colin was doing. But there was this, people thought, oh, I reached out to Colin and told him to protest. Or I, who knows what, you know, or I said, hey man, you should take a knee, because America sucks, or whatever. There's some crazy ones out there that have, like, some crazy narratives in the whole story. And yes, I got a ton of, and I still do, and it's all good. Like, I, you know what, that you said it earlier, talking about freedom of speech and rights. At the end of the day, in the military, no matter what you did in the military, you know, if you were in special forces or any other job, you took the same oath, and that was to defend the Constitution, which includes the First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of expression. And so I also defend to the death those that absolutely abhor the fact that I even had a conversation with Colin Kaepernick. You know what I mean? It's their right to feel that way. All I can do is try to help them understand why, not only why he was doing, but why I felt like it was my duty to at least listen to him, you know, have a conversation. When he asked me a question like, hey, do you think there's something else I could do besides sit that's not going to offend people in the military? And by the way, my answer was no. Like, there's nothing you can do that's not going to offend some people. I mean, everybody, military, we're just as individual and diverse as the rest of the, well, probably more than the rest of the country. I mean, we are every color, religion, belief, political stance you can imagine. And we train together, we fight together, we're willing to take a bullet for one another, but off the field, off the battlefield, like, we're very different, much like a, you know, football locker room. We're very different. We don't always like each other, but we can put that stuff aside and, like, figure things out, solve problems together, like Colin and I were trying to do in that when it comes to just the situation or just the question of what's more respectful protest-wise, gesture-wise, or what's more of a uniting symbol, or, you know, how are people taking this? I mean, he cared enough to ask that. And that's gotten lost quite a bit too. And so I just want people to understand that from his standpoint. It was definitely not easy what he was doing, but I think it was also difficult, especially in how quick that timeline all went down. I mean, from him protesting a week or two earlier to all of a sudden we're sitting down having a conversation. He's asking me, hey man, like, I care enough to, like, I don't want to offend people in the military. I don't want to offend you. What do you think? And I gave a suggestion and he did it, you know? I mean, that's a pretty big move, I think.
You talk to him, obviously, on a regular basis. I know you did at some point. Where's his mind at right now? Many believe, I'm one of them, he's going to get a tryout, and teams now are going to take 3 quarterbacks, according to some reports, because of the virus and the concern that somebody could get COVID. He'll make the NFL if that's the case. When's the last time you talked to him? Did you talk football at all?
I haven't talked to him in a couple of years. And so it was 3.5 years ago when we met. We talked through that season into the next season a bit. Always, you know, very respectful, positive. There's no reason we don't speak, you know. It's just a matter of that. I mean, he's getting hit up from all directions, especially times like this. It's really hard. But even before that, you know, it's like different paths. We're doing different things. I'm working a lot in the veteran community. He's doing his thing. But you know, I mean, nothing but respect. And to speak on that, yeah, I mean, it just comes down to me, like, and people will argue with me and they're like, of course he wants to play. You know, he did that workout, whatever, several months ago, you know, down in Atlanta. And I was like, the fact of the matter is to me is if he's definitely a starter, it's a different conversation. And if it's any other position where everybody plays, except for, you know, in quarterback, the only position where only one guy plays every week, every other position, people cycle in, rotate in, everybody gets, you know, plays some. If he's not a starter, is it worth it to him? And it's like, is that not going to be a little bit odd? And you know, where does he go? What team does he go to? And then you've got a situation where maybe they're in training camp and they're competing and maybe he's, you know, just as good or better in some ways than he had been towards the end of his career. And it's like competing for the starting job. Like, there's going to be politics involved with that. I would think. And then, or say he starts the season as a backup and then the starter, maybe has a couple good games, then a couple bad games. Then all of a sudden there's clamoring of like, why isn't he playing? And it turns into this whole thing. Like, does he want to be in the middle of that? I don't know. I honestly don't know, because he's done so much more off the field for the world, you know, for the country, for a cause that many people believe in. He's been a spokesperson for that. So does that person, you know, is that person a backup quarterback ever? Is there even a scenario for that? I don't know.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I've said this. I said we should probably ask him. I think three and a half years of inactivity, and he wasn't playing particularly well the last time he played. It's just a long time. Michael Vick missed a couple of years, came back, sat for a year, struggled to beat out Kevin Cobb, and Michael Vick was great. So, you know, I think if you have 3 quarterbacks in the league per team, he's in. And I still think he probably wins a job somewhere, But the quality of quarterback play has never been better in my life, and the quality of backup quarterback play is pretty darn good. And I think it's very difficult to be out of a professional sport when you were kind of a marginal player for 3.5 years. Michael Jordan took 18 months off and acknowledged, I'm not the same player, and he's the best basketball player most believe ever easily. So we'll see. You know what? I'm here for it. I'm in the interesting business. You know, at the point of the point with you and Kaepernick a couple years ago, was there ever a moment where you thought, man, people are just never going to get this? They're just never going to quite understand what Colin's about. Were you ever at that point?
I mean, I still am when it comes to certain people. And I think I've realized more, or at least accepted, that some people just don't want to. They just don't want it. It doesn't matter what you say. It doesn't matter. It'll never be enough, or it'll never be something they'll reason with. And that's okay. That's just, some people are like that. And I definitely had moments, I think, especially over that first year he was out. So I would say that's 2017, that season.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, just a year off of when we met, you know, his first year out of the league. And there was obviously, that was when we started hearing a lot of conversations about collusion and all this stuff. And then, yeah, there was just certain people that it doesn't matter. It didn't matter how many times it was explained, the why, you know, the narrative of why, like I said earlier, police brutality, social justice, racial inequality. It didn't matter. They were like, it doesn't matter. He's disrespecting my country because the flag means X, Y, and Z, not A, B, and C. And it's like, well, yeah, it means that to you. It means that to you. It means that to you. And you could say it a million times and they just never would. But to look at where we're at now, and I've had a ton of people, so I can't even imagine how many feel this way that didn't reach out to me. I've had a ton of people reach out to me from honestly from both sides of this argument, you know, that have said either, and I'd say more so on the kind of conservative side, I guess, that said, hey, look, you know what, I was really offended and it still hurts me when I see this, but I finally understand, I think, why, and I'm listening to that. And I, you know what, I respect you, Nate, for at least having the conversation. And I absolutely respect his right to do that. And I don't have to like it. And that's okay. That's what America is supposed to be all about.
That's right.
That feels great to me when I see that and hear that, especially from, and some of those people have been guys that MF'd me from the jump that I served with, you know what I mean? And so like that really, man, it's good to feel that. And that's going back to your first question. That's why sometimes I do feel a responsibility to engage, not in a combative way, but with all these guys, but just an explaining, no matter what they say to me, just be like, hey, look, man, I understand you feel this way and you have every right to feel this way. This is why I did it. This is how I feel. Because I mean, I want Colin and everybody to stand, but I want them to stand because they feel like I do, or at least some semblance of that. I want them to feel pride in their country. I don't want them to stand or do anything out of obligation. That's not American to me. So, you know, there has been that, and that's a good thing. That's a really positive thing that I'm glad for, you know. And it's a crazy year, though, Colin. I'll say that. 2020 is nuts.
Former U.S. Army Green Beret, served in Iraq, 2 tours in Afghanistan. Nate Boyer is joining us. You know, I thought I'd ask you. You've got a military background. What is the end game or a realistic solution for you for a systemic reform among police departments and the force used when you watch that story developing and the changes? What is a realistic solution? We need police protection, but it is too often brutal and punitive and harsh. What's the end game? What's the solution or an idea for one?
Yeah, well, I think one of the major things, and this is something that this movement's been pushing for a long time, is accountability for law enforcement members. You know, when stuff like this happens and it's a very clear wrongdoing, it's not a paid leave situation. That's something Colin said way back in 2016, and more, I mean, even myself at first, I was like, and often would say, yeah, but it's nuanced. I mean, this job's hard. Trust me. I know. I was in the military. It's not that simple. And it isn't that simple. The job is hard, but there's still, to a point, there's just absolutely no excuse for acting a certain way, having a certain mentality behind that badge, you know, when you go out the door. It doesn't matter where you're patrolling. It doesn't matter what your background, who you are. So that's got to be a very specific part of the training and a very specific part of, you know, evaluations for for people that are joining the force, people that have been on for a long time, because we can't have that mentality. But then when things like this happen, there's got to be major repercussions, major, you know, or it's not going to change. You have to have that feeling of risk. Like, okay, if I do something that I can't just get away with it and say, well, you know, I felt threatened. It's like, okay, you know, the job is threatening. It's a tough job. And I know it doesn't pay well. And I know it's going to be really hard for us to find good cops at this point. That's something we need to focus on as well. But that's got to be, you know, you're volunteering to do this. You're stepping up. And we're grateful for that because we need police officers. We need law enforcement, like you said. But there's, you know, there's a level of integrity you have to maintain because you have to have that in the military. I mean, if you go overseas and you treat people, you know, the wrong way, and you do something to civilians or even a situation against bad guys that aren't armed. You know, we have specific rules of engagement. There's repercussions. There's major repercussions for that. And like, we need to have those same standards in the police force, because the next step moving forward for me, well, not the next step, but one of the next steps, one of the most important steps is like bringing honor back to what it is to wear that badge, you know, so young people of all colors are like, oh, wow, cool, police officer, you know, thank you. You know, you serve and protect me. Like, we've got to get that feeling back, which means we've got to see that on the streets and feel like that's what they're actually doing, so that we have the right people taking that oath, you know what I mean?
Right.
Joining those departments. We have to have the right people from, a lot of them, probably more of them from those neighborhoods to take pride in it. And we've got to take pride in it as well. So like, that's going to definitely take time with where it's at right now, the way that they're viewed. But you know, just this, to me, the abolishment is just like, I mean, anything super extreme, it just doesn't make sense. There's got to be a middle ground here.
Yeah. I've never had an extreme position, honestly, in my life. I mean, I think my DNA, my genetics, my parents were moderates.
Humans.
And so, yeah, I mean, I usually don't like absolutes and extremes, and, I can understand, that we change, and fundamentally the way police departments operate needs
Absolutely.
To be changed. But I do think police protection is vital. You're a world traveler. You're a guy that goes all over the world. When you watch police departments globally, do you sense a more aggressive nature from our domestic police force than you do in other parts of the world?
I do. I do. You know, and I'm saying that about countries that are fully developed, because it is a very different situation when you're in some of these very undeveloped countries. There's a lot of corruption and all that stuff. Not that there's not corruption probably in our departments at some level, but I'm comparing it to countries that are sort of on our, on the tier of like a first, you know, something you'd say this is a first world country.
Right.
Yes. And I think there's a bit of reason behind that too. I mean, we are so diverse and, we do have a lot of, you know, internal problems as well. So that's part of it, but it is, I don't know what exactly, central model that part of that is. And people, I've learned this through this process that, you know, the actual police forces that, you know, we have today, they were, a lot of them were started during, you know, slavery, and they were essentially slave catchers. So it was like, that's what a lot of that was born out of. And I'm not saying in any way that is what these people exactly are doing today. People might argue with me on that and say that they are, but, you know, it's sort of born out of that. So it was like, it's less of originally it was less of, I guess, of this idea of sort of, you know, protecting the herd, looking after the flock, making sure it's pure protection, and more like, you know, we've got to get people and get them behind bars, and you know, we got to get the bad guys, and the bad guys, you know, look a certain way. And so I think there's still elements of that, absolutely. And it's kind of crazy. And I'm just learning about that. I'm just trying to like get caught up and understand, because I'm a white guy that was never involved or even really interested, admittingly, in social justice until I met with Colin, until 2016. And I was just frustrated with my country being divided. And I wanted to figure out a way to like get people to calm down and listen. And then it's like, I've had to do a lot of learning myself, and I still have a lot to do, but so there's that. I mean, it's just with our past, we're a very young country, but with our past and for for many people in this country, you know, ancestral, looking back, you know, with how they were brought here, a lot of, you know, obviously black people, people from Africa, how they were brought here, the opportunity or lack thereof that they've had for years and years and years. And like, yes, slavery was abolished. Yes, we had the civil rights movement, but there's a lot of lingering effects. And there's a lot of people that were born into a place where they felt like they didn't have hope. They didn't have opportunity. They didn't have equal rights. And that still exists. That's not gone. Just because we don't have, you know, legal segregation, it doesn't mean that segregation doesn't still exist. And doesn't mean that, you know, racial inequality, you know, racism and bias, even within our law enforcement, doesn't still exist. And so it's something we have to just keep working towards and keep rooting out. And I think over the last couple of weeks, we're seeing such an outcry from so many that maybe now there's going to be a pretty dramatic shift in the way that that's done finally. And even when it's done, and even when all these, the training changes and the rules change and, you know, policing is different, it's not going to just be solved. It's not just going to be fixed. We have to continue to work towards it and like maintain it. And that's just, that's how things are in general. You know, you can't just tweak a few things in the manual and all of a sudden the problem's fixed. Like, we have to have incredible oversight. And, you know, we've got to, like I said earlier, find a way to bring back that honor to the badge so that we have the right people signing up, you know, seeing that billboard when they're driving down the 110 that says join our law enforcement and think like, you know what, I want to do that. I want to help protect my community. But I also feel like that's a cool job. That's a good job. And right now you'll be hard pressed to find a lot of people, especially people of color, I would imagine, that feel that way.
He co-founded MVP, Merging Vets and Players, with Jay Glazer. It empowers combat veterans and former professional athletes by connecting them after the uniform comes off. You know, our president called in the National Guard during these protests. I don't know if it was necessary. I don't have a strong conviction either way. How did that land for you?
You know, that's a tough one. I mean, I think most of those men and women in uniform probably don't want to be out there policing or protecting their own streets. You know, they don't want to be doing. That's not why they joined. I was in the National Guard when I was in college at Texas. You know, and Austin has experienced. You know, they've had protests. Most of them, to my knowledge, have been very very peaceful. But still, they had guard members that were called in. So there's a possibility I would be called in. And I can't imagine having to be in that situation and feeling like I don't even disagree with what these people are protesting about. But to them, they maybe see me as like someone that's not there to protect their right to do that, which I'm supposed to be, but someone that's there to oppose it, you know, or to protect against them being potentially dangerous. And of course you're armed and you're in camouflage and like you have all these things going on. So there's going to be stereotypes and generalizations made about who you are behind that uniform. And that's happening with cops too, which isn't fair. And I'm not defending people that have done the wrong thing. There's plenty of people in the military that have done the wrong thing, you know, used force when not needed. And at this point in our nation's history, we call them all heroes. You know, everybody in the military, oh, you're a hero. But it's like, okay, well, what if I told you that there was people like that, you know, in the uniform that have done things like these police officers have done overseas? You know, would you say the same thing? Would you feel the same way? Just because you can't see it on your own land, you know, on your own television screen at home. So that all being said, like, they're in a tough spot, the National Guard members. And there's no doubt been ones that have done things they probably shouldn't have done just in these last 2 weeks, you know. But that is, that's a difficult position. I mean, I can only imagine, like, it being 2013, 2014, I'm still on the Longhorns, you know, and maybe somebody recognized me in that uniform, the camouflage, you know, and they're just like, that's the guy that plays, that's the long snapper for the Longhorns. What the hell is he doing on that side? You know? And it's just like, no. It's not, it shouldn't be about sides, especially when you're there to serve and protect, you know, you're there to serve and protect those rights, you know, when done peacefully, especially that First Amendment right is a very American one. And that's what we all took the oath to defend in the military, and I think in law enforcement as well. So that's a sticky position. And I feel for a lot of those men and women, because they most of them probably don't want to be there in that situation.
Nate, you've obviously flourished as a former member of the U.S. Army. When people come back from multiple tours, do they generally flourish? Do you feel like the exception? Is it the kind of career that is elevating people, or do you worry that it's not?
It absolutely is a type of career that's elevating people. One of the big problems is, and you touched on it, you mentioned MVP, which stands for Emerging Vets and Players. So we bring together combat vets, former professional athletes, help them find purpose and mission and that team again when the uniform comes off. We also help them remember who they were and sort of like reignite that human being, that person that was willing to sacrifice so much to be elite, that person with all those skills, those warrior diplomats, as I mentioned earlier. So it does elevate people, most of the time. And you develop so much grit, an ability to survive, adapt, overcome, all those things we talk about, improvise. We problem solve. And like I talked about earlier, that sense of team and that willingness to, regardless of our differences, put that stuff aside and work together with others towards a common goal, right? But it's so easy to forget, especially when that career ends in your 20s and 30s and you feel like I'll never be great again. I've peaked, you know what I mean? I'll never have that rush I had inside when I was over there in Iraq, in Afghanistan, wherever in the world, protecting these people, literally fighting to free the oppressed, which the Special Forces motto is De Oppressor Liber, which means to free the oppressed. But that's what everybody's doing in our military in a lot of these places. So you have that elevated sense of purpose, that's really hard to match. So then you come back home. I was really lucky. You talked about how I've been able to sort of transition. I was really lucky, not even knowing it, that I had football, like my American dream to chase when I came home.
Yeah.
And I started training for that when I was in Iraq. So I came home and I kind of rolled right into that. I never thought about that transition. I never had that moment of like, well, now I'm just a civilian. I got to figure it out. I had a team that I kind of went right into. I had a mission, a goal, trying, going to college. And it was very different. I mean, I was 10 years older than the other freshmen, but I had something that definitely occupied, my mind. It was challenging. And a lot of people, they don't have that. And then so when I felt when I really felt that transition struggle was when football ended, when I got cut from the Seahawks.
Yeah.
And I was I'd gotten out of the military just a couple of months before that. All of a sudden, I got neither. And that's why we started MVP, because I had that feeling, and it scared me. And I knew a lot of other people, both in sports, but especially in the military, felt that same way. And I know also what we're capable of. I think we're the types of – we're the group of people, those professional athletes, military vets, maybe more than any other groups in the country, that will help bring us back together, help solve a lot of these problems that we've been talking about on this podcast. And, fight for those that can't fight for themselves. Continue to do that for our country not only uniting us, but solving all these problems, because they are real issues. They're not just first world problems. They're real world problems, and we got to fix them. But we need that type of leadership, and we need that background. We need people that have developed that grit, that know how to overcome, that don't know how to quit. We need those people now more than ever.
Nate Boyer, at Nate Boyer 37 is his social media Twitter account. Thanks for joining our Saturday podcast, Nate.
Thank you, Colin. I appreciate you, brother. Thanks for having me on. Thanks for being moderate. That's all.
Thank you.
Just be reasonable.